We must be careful in trying to interpret providence, because our view of affairs in life are very limited and are also very subjective. I think I've run across people who, in their lives, view everything that happens to them as by the providence of God. And God does not so order our affairs that every little minute detail is something that He's predetermined and foreordained from eternity. We have the right of choice. He leaves us that right of choice. He does not infringe upon those choices. And when He foreordained and predestinated some things relating to our salvation, those things relate to our relationship in Jesus Christ. As the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world, He was God's planning and purposing. And as the Creator of the world, certainly He has the right to rule the creation. So God certainly is in control of life, but He does not so order every event that takes place in my life. And so I have to be careful when I look at things that transpire in my life that I don't say, well, God did that. Sometimes they are a result of my own wrong decisions, since I have the right to choose not only good, but evil. And sometimes they are the consequence of Satan operating in a world that God allows him to operate to test and to try my faith. Remember that Job was a righteous man. And because he was a righteous man, God allowed Satan to test him. He allowed Satan to take everything from him that he owned. And Job simply said, God gives and God takes away. He resigned himself to things that he could not understand. And there are lots of things that the Bible tells us that the secret things belong to God. And we have to take some refuge in that we do not know all things. And so we must be very careful in interpreting our affairs about the providence of God. I pointed out this morning, particularly the best rule to use in interpreting providence is hindsight. You look back upon your life and there's some things that you can obviously see relate to God working in your life. And these things happen in your life because you, first of all, had a good attitude about God, and you prayed about the affairs of your life. You put God first, and you said, God, I want to do everything that is pleasing to Thee. And so you tried to order your affairs based upon that. Remember also, we said, that while we know the will of God, that's here in His Word, what He wants us to do, how He expects us to act, and He's revealed that by words. He's communicated His mind by words. And we can know what He wants of us by that. There is also a will of His relating to providence that we do not know. In James, the 4th chapter, when we looked at verses 13 down through verse 15, James talks about those who make their plans. And he says, go to now, ye that say today or tomorrow. We'll go into such and such a city, continue there a year, buy and sell and get gain. He says, for as you know not what your life is, it is even as a vapor that appeareth for a little time and then vanisheth away. But you ought to say, if the Lord will. Well, that's fine, but I don't always know what the Lord wills. And so we've tried, Margaret and I, in our lives, we've tried to order our affairs based upon some decisions that we are responsible to make, where we're going to live, where we're going to work, relating to life itself and the things that we're trying to do. And it's always prefaced upon, if the Lord will. And we don't always know beforehand, but we pray that and we trust in God. And we put our faith in His providence to deal with us in the way that is best for what is glorifying Him and the best for us. But we don't always know what that is, especially if we don't know that beforehand. And so I caution you again that when you look at providence in your life, use hindsight as the best rule for interpreting that providence. It's the only way you can have some idea about how God has worked in your life. With that in mind, we looked at what providence meant. And the word providence simply means the idea of foreseeing. But not just looking into the future, but looking with the idea of having in mind provision. It is not enough that a person sees something that needs to be done. There must also be the thought in mind of doing something to provide for what is seen or anticipated in the future. And God's foresight is that which anticipates His doing something in reference to what He has seen. There are two ways in which we may categorize providence. We may, by generally talking about providence, in an area where God set things in order in nature, He established laws in nature, and He works in His way in dealing with mankind, in dealing with the world, the affairs of the world, in that area of general providence. And sometimes we may talk about providence in a specific sense. We may see, as God has revealed it to us in His Word, that He's intervened in some way, in a very specific way, to accomplish something that He wants to accomplish. And we also said you may classify providence as miraculous or as non-miraculous. Sometimes He works in the world in a way that is within the area of natural laws. There are other times when He intervenes and supersedes the natural laws to operate in a way that we call miraculous. And we used a very simple illustration of the difference between Hannah, who prayed for a child and God gave her that child, but it was through natural means. Her husband knew her, she conceived, and they bore a child. But unlike that was the birth of Jesus. For the Holy Spirit came upon Mary, and she conceived miraculously. She was a virgin. She had never known man. So this was not and could not have been in a natural way that Jesus was born. So we keep those categories in mind. And as we look particularly at the idea of the general classification providence in reference to what takes place in the general world and providence in reference to God's maneuvering or God's operating in such a way that is a very specific way. Now, tonight I'm going to spend the time that we have in looking at two instances in Bible history where we find God promising something, foretelling something, and then we see Him as He works that out. And the stories are familiar to you, so if you'll bear with me, we'll try not to be too tedious. But in the accounts, what I want to do is, as we see them unfold, is to see particularly how God maneuvers, how He works, how He uses sometimes the evil of man to accomplish what He might want to accomplish in the final good. Turn your attention, first of all, to the book of Genesis. And our study here begins in the 37th chapter. Actually, it precedes that. But we're just going to pick up at this point in time. It talks about, in this instance, the account in the life of Joseph. And our children are familiar with this story. And again, I'll try not to be too tedious. But follow along carefully what transpires in the life of Joseph. Joseph was beloved of his father. And you remember he had some dreams. And he told these dreams to his father and to his mother and to his brethren. And his brothers got very upset about those dreams. And he didn't understand what those dreams meant. But God was saying something to him at a very early age that was going to happen, and God was going to bring it to pass as time passed. Now, in the intervening time from the dreams that he had in the 37th chapter that bring us on down to the 45th chapter and finally into the 50th chapter, we see how God worked all of this to accomplish it in His providence. Now, let's relate very briefly what took place in the life of Joseph. Joseph was hated by his brothers because they conceived of him, first of all, as being loved more by his father, but also as a dreamer. And they saw some significance in the dream that he had of their bowing down before him. Now, in the 39th chapter, we find it unfolding more. And then in the 40th chapter, I want to pick up with the idea of Joseph's life in Egypt as he was sold by his brothers. Now, you know that because of their jealousy, that they took Joseph and they sold him to the Midianites, and he ended up in the land of Egypt in bondage. He was a prisoner. Now, if we walk with Joseph side by side with him, and we looked at Joseph's life at that point in time, what would we say about the providence of God? What would be our subjective interpretation about Joseph's life? Well, we'd probably say something like Job's friends did. Joseph, you must have committed some sin. Because a man that's a good man, a boy that's a good boy, would not be sold and end up down here in prison in Egypt. That's contrary to the way God works. But you see, we interpret things just on a very limited basis and a very limited point of time. Joseph prospered. In Potiphar's house, he became second in command to Potiphar himself. Nothing went on in his house that Joseph didn't know about. But we have an evil person involved in the life of Joseph, and Potiphar's wife tries to get Joseph to commit sin with him, and he refuses and finally flees and leaves behind his coat, and Potiphar's wife falsely charges him, and Potiphar believes that. Now, here's a man that has done no wrong. He's been a good boy. He's a very righteous boy. And again, we look at Joseph, and now from being exalted, which we would think, if we were there with Joseph, God is with you, because look how He's exalted you. And now all of a sudden, everything is taken away from him, and he's falsely charged when he was righteous, and he's cast into prison. So at that point in time, we would stand beside Joseph, we'd say again, Joseph, you certainly did something bad. Look at how God is punishing you. And yet Joseph had a better view, I think, of God's providence and his trust in God than we might have had. But keep in mind how we vacillate based upon our subjective analysis of the providence of God. Well, Joseph stayed in prison for a while, finally interpreted the dream of the butler and the baker, as you know. And then in time, Pharaoh had a dream. And in fact, he had two dreams of the cows, the fat cows and the skinny cows and the fat sheaves of corn and the skinny sheaves of corn. And the skinny ones ate the fat ones, and the kids know what that meant. When Joseph was finally called in to interpret the dream, he told Pharaoh, this is what the dream means. There's going to be 7 years of plenty, of abundance. That's going to be followed by 7 years of famine. Now, he said, you need to select someone who's going to be wise and who's going to take care of the affairs when there is prosperity, so that when there is famine or lack, then you're going to have enough. And, of course, Pharaoh was quite impressed with Joseph's interpretation, and so he appointed Joseph. Now, all of a sudden, from the depths of prison, where he had spent a couple of years, he's now exalted to second in command to Pharaoh. And now we stand beside Joseph and we say, Joseph, now you're doing good. Look at how God has provided for you. Look at how you're blessed. And God now is blessing you because you've been good. But why would we not say that when Joseph was in prison? We don't see the whole picture. We don't see how God works things out. Now, I want to call your attention to something. And we're going to back up for just a moment to the 12th and the 15th and 22nd chapters of Genesis, because I want you to see how this unfolds. In the 12th chapter of Genesis, God spoke to Abram. And he called Abram from the Ur of the Chaldees, and he said to him, I will bless thee and make thy name great. This is verse 2 of chapter 12. And thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee, and in thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. Now that's the first time that God makes this promise to Abram. Look at the 15th chapter. He renews this promise again, and the whole chapter is interesting. But in chapter 15 and in verse 5 and 6, he brought him forth abroad and said, look now toward heaven and tell the stars, if thou be able to number them. And he said unto them, so shall thy seed be. And he believed in the Lord, and he counted it to him for righteousness. In the 22nd chapter, and now we jump on over a little bit farther to the time in which Isaac has been born, and God now has told Abram to take his son Isaac and to offer him. And Abram does this. And now as he obeys God, God again renews that promise to Abram and renews the time in which he will bless him. And again we see the faith of Abraham coming to the surface. In verse 14 of the 22nd chapter, and Abram called the name of that place Jehovah Jireh, as he said to this day, in the mount of the Lord it shall be seen. In verse 17 he says, that in blessing I will bless thee, and in multiplying I will multiply thy seed as the stars of heaven, and as the sand which is upon the seashore. And thy seed shall possess the gate of his enemies. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed, because thou hast obeyed my voice." Now, there are three things that God has promised to Abram, who became Abraham. "I'll make of thee a great nation. I will give you a land. And in thy seed," singular, "will all the nations of the earth be blessed." Now, I want to back up and just keep these thoughts in mind for a moment to the 15th chapter again. When God had spoke this to Abraham and made this promise, Abram says, "How can I know? How can I know that what you're saying is true?" And this involved the time of the sacrificing and the laying of the halves side by side and the establishment of the covenant that God made with Abram. But now let's turn our attention and look at verse 15 and following of chapter 15. "And thou shalt go to thy fathers in peace. Thou shalt be buried in a good old age. But in the fourth generation, they shall come hither again, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet full." Now, just let that thought stick in your mind. Here, God made this promise to Abram. And now he says, it's not going to happen yet, Abram. You're going to die in a full old age. You're going to go to be with your fathers. In the fourth generation, it's going to happen. I'm going to make of your seed a great nation. And he says, because I cannot give the land yet, since the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full. God must act consistent with his nature, even in his providence. And he does that. And we're going to see how that unfolds. Now, we turn our attention back to the account of Joseph. And again, remember how all of this fits into the providence of God as it is being developed. We left Joseph in the land of Egypt, having been elevated to second to Pharaoh himself. The 7 years of plenty pass. Grain has been stored through the wisdom of Joseph. The 7 years of famine began. And the famine reaches not only the land of Egypt, but it reaches also up into the land of Canaan. And since Jacob is staying there, he and his family are affected by the drought, by the famine. And he sends his sons down to Egypt. I've heard there's grain down there. And he sends them down there to buy grain. Joseph recognizes his brothers. They don't recognize him. And the story goes on about how he returned the money, put it in the sack, sent them back. He kept Simeon. And then in order for them to go back again, they're going to have to bring Benjamin. And Jacob just cannot bear that. And Judah speaks up, "I'll take care of him. I'll give myself a surety for him." And they finally go back the second time, and then Joseph again recognizes them, and he puts the money back in the sack again, but he puts the gold cup in the sack of Benjamin, doesn't he? You kids awake? Staying up with the story? All right. What happens then? Well, now when the servants of Joseph find that this cup is there, and they make these charges against him, they take them back down the land of Egypt, and Joseph is speaking quite roughly with them. And then finally it says he could bear it no more. And so he broke down and he wept and he told them, "I'm your brother. I'm the brother that you sold into captivity." Now let's go, if you will, in chapter 45. And we'll read just a few of the verses in particular rather than paraphrasing. In verse 3, Joseph said to his brethren, "I am Joseph. Doth my father yet live?" And his brethren could not answer him, for they were troubled at his presence. And Joseph said unto his brethren, "Come near to me, I pray you." And they came near, and he said, "I am Joseph, your brother, whom ye sold into Egypt." Now, there are two ways in which he puts this. He really says, "You did it," but he says, "God was behind it." And he doesn't mean by this that you're not responsible because God was behind it. What he means is that God was using their bad decisions to accomplish something good. You see the providence of God then working out. In verse 7, "And God sent me before you to preserve you a posterity in the earth and save your lives by a great deliverance. So now it was not you but that sent me hither, but God." And again, I point out, he's not saying you didn't make the choice and you weren't responsible and you weren't evil by doing it. But there was an overriding influence of God that used you. They were responsible for that choice. And he says, He hath made me a father to Pharaoh, and lord of all his house, and a ruler throughout all the land of Egypt. Haste ye, and go up to my father, and say unto him, Thus saith thy son Joseph, God hath made me lord of all Egypt. Come down unto me, and tarry not. Now, do you see how things have evolved in the life of Joseph? And you see how that if we had been with him at certain points in time, and we had interpreted the providence of God, then we would be saying to Joseph, something's wrong, Joseph. You're a good boy, you're a good man, you're doing righteous, and bad things are happening to you. That means that God must not love you. But we don't see the whole picture. And that's what people do a lot of times in their own lives, both in a good way and a bad way. And so this again is the reason for this caution. Many times people look at their lives and they see good things happening and they interpret their relationship with God based on the good things that are happening. But good things happen to evil people too. Good things happen to atheists. Good things happen to people who are grossly immoral. So that's not the basis of interpreting our relationship with God. In interpreting providence, we need to see how the things unfold. We need to see the whole picture as it develops. Because at points in time, we would certainly make an observation about Joseph that something wasn't right in his relationship with God. Finally, God had exalted Joseph to second in place behind Pharaoh. But now, why did he do that? In chapter 46, and he says in verse 3, I am the God of thy father. Fear not to go down into Egypt, for I will there make of thee a great nation. This he speaks to Jacob. I'm going to make of you, but you see how God did that? Depending on how you count the numbers, there were 70 or 75 or 77 that went down in the land of Egypt. That was the total of those in the lineage of Abraham to whom God had said, I will make you a great nation. And he said, not only will I make you a great nation, and your seed is numberless as the stars of heaven and the sands of the seashore, but I will give you a land. It's not going to happen yet, Abram. Not to the fourth generation. But now God is working to accomplish what he promised in his providence. I'm going to make of you a great nation. So when they all move down to Egypt, and they stay there, and they prosper, and they multiply, when they finally come up out of the land of Egypt in the Exodus, there were over 600,000 men of fighting age, not counting women and children, not counting the babies, not counting the old people, but 600,000 men who were of fighting age. Now, by a conservative estimate, you're looking at 2 or 3 million people. God did this, and he did it in a way that seems quite unusual, but it was in his providence. He was providing what he promised to Abram. I'm going to make of you a great nation. Now let's go over to the 50th chapter, and I want to look at verse 20. Now this is the account, as we've jumped on over into the future, in this historical account. This is the time when Jacob now is dead. And they've taken him and buried him. And the brothers are very disturbed. Do you know why? Why, sure you know why. All this time has passed, and still in the back of their minds is this idea, we sold our brother into captivity, and nothing has been done to us. The father, in their minds, seemed to be protecting. Jacob, the old patriarch, was protecting them. And now, if you will, look at verse 15 and following. And when Joseph's brethren saw that their father was dead, they said, Joseph will peradventure hate us and will certainly requite us all the evil which we did unto him. And they sent a messenger unto Joseph, saying, Thy father did command before he died, saying, So shall you say unto Joseph, Forgive, I pray thee now. I don't think this is true, but they're certainly taking care of themselves. The trespass of thy brethren and their sin, for they did unto thee evil. And now we pray thee, forgive the trespass of the servants of the God of thy father. And Joseph wept when they spake unto him. And his brethren also went and fell down before his face. You see, that's a part of the fulfillment of the dream that Joseph had when he was just a child. And said, "Behold, we be thy servants." Joseph said, "Fear not, for I in the place, for am I in the place of God? But as for you, you thought evil against me, but God meant it unto good, to bring to pass, as is this day, to save much people alive." God, in his providence, worked through Joseph. And Joseph is perhaps one of the best examples that we can find. And we can see how God did this. If we didn't have the whole story, and we just picked it up at different times in Joseph's life, our interpretation of providence would be very distorted. But Joseph had a very clear perception of God's providence. He says, "You intended it for evil." They were responsible for that. That was their choice. But God used them, and he overrode that which they intended for evil to accomplish what was good. This is how God worked in providence to fulfill the promise that he made to Abraham. Now, the last thing that we looked at when we went to Genesis chapter 15 was the promise that God made of giving them the land. He says, "But I can't do it yet because the iniquity of the Amorite is not yet full." Why didn't God just bless them abundantly and in a few years when there were a vast number of people, take them out and sweep through the land of Canaan and the Amorites? Because God could not violate his own nature. The iniquity of the Amorite had to reach its capacity. It had to be full before God could, in his justness, remove them from the land before he could punish them. And all of this worked out as God planned it. And he accomplished it because God, the Creator, certainly is in control of the creation. But he never acts contrary to his nature. That's part of the reason that when you look at providence, you want to be careful about the interpretation that you place upon it. Because sometimes, as I said, people make an interpretation of providence in their lives that really is contrary to the nature of God. Illustration, again. When a person looks at his life and he says, "I am being prospered, I have so much, I'm happy, things are going so good," that means I'm right with God. Non sequitur. It does not follow. And it does not follow because in a natural world, good things happen to good people and good things happen to bad people. And bad things happen to good people too. And that's not the basis of interpreting one's relationship with God. That's a very subjective analysis. It's a wrong interpretation of providence. Second illustration. And this takes us to the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. That begins in the 9th chapter of Acts and will eventually take us all the way through the 28th chapter of Acts. And I know you're excited about going through all of this history, but we're not going to cover it in detail. I want to pick out again the significant events and look particularly at what God had in mind for Saul of Tarsus, who became the Apostle Paul, and what he had for Paul to accomplish in his life. In the 9th chapter of Acts, we find the account of the conversion of Saul of Tarsus. We're just going to pick up a few verses here and then proceed on throughout the account of the book of Acts later in some of these chapters. Now, as Saul, it says, and let me see which verse I want to start with. Saul was breathing out threatening his slaughters, chapter 9, verse 1. The Lord said, "It's hard for you to kick against the pricks." And the men stood speechless as they heard the voice. A certain man in Damascus, a disciple named Ananias, came to Saul. And here now we will pick up on the words that Saul, that Ananias said to Saul. And he said in verse 12, and we'll just start with the vision, "A man named Ananias coming in, putting his hand on him and that he might receive his sight. Then Ananias answered, 'Lord, I've heard by many of this man how much evil he hath done to the saints at Jerusalem. And here he hath authority from the chief priest to bind all that call on the name.' And the Lord said, 'Go thy way, for he is a chosen vessel unto me to bear my name before the Gentiles and kings and the children of Israel. For I will show him how great things he must suffer for my name's sake." Now that's the account that you find of the conversion. But let's go over to the 22nd chapter. Actually, starting in the 21st chapter, he rehearses his conversion in the 22nd chapter and the defense he makes. And hold that thought for just a moment, because I want to go back and pick up something that he wrote to the church at Rome. In Romans chapter 1, as he wrote to the Roman brethren, he was desirous of coming to Rome that he might see them and that he might impart to them some gift that they might be complete. He says in verse 10, "Making request, if by any means, now at length, I might have a prosperous journey by the will of God to come unto you." You see, he says, by the will of God. "For I long to see you, that I may impart unto you some spiritual gift, to the end ye may be established. That is, that I may be comforted together with you by the mutual faith, both of you and me." Now that's the beginning of the letter. And let's just drop on over to the 15th chapter toward the close of the letter. Following his statements in reference to why he's going to Jerusalem, in verse 28, beginning of chapter 15, "When therefore I have performed this and have sealed to them this fruit, I will come by you into Spain. And I'm sure that when I come unto you, I shall come in the fullness of the blessing of the gospel of Christ. Now I beseech you, brethren, for the Lord Jesus Christ's sake, and for the love of the Spirit, that you strive together with me in your prayers to God for me, that I may be delivered from them that do not believe in Judea, and that my service which I have for Jerusalem may be accepted for the saints, that I may come unto you with joy by the will of God, and may with you be refreshed. Now the God of peace be with you all. Amen." Paul wanted to go to Rome. He prayed that he might go to Rome, that he might see the brethren. He asked the brethren to pray for him that he might go to Rome. But how it all happened is what's going to unfold now in the historical part of this account. When we look at Paul's third journey, and this picks up in the latter part of Romans 15 that we did not read, verse 25 and 26. And 1 Corinthians 16, verse 1 and verse 2, taking a gift for the poor saints in Jerusalem. But when he came back to Jerusalem, in the 21st chapter of the book of Acts, we find that there was concern for Paul in reference to some things that were being said about him. And so the elders of the church in Jerusalem proposed that he go in and perform a part of the vow that was taken, that they might understand that Paul was not saying what they were saying. They had accused Paul of teaching that men could not keep the customs of the law. Paul never taught that. So he did this, he shared in this vow, that he might convince the Jews that this was not a true rumor. It was a false rumor. Now something happened as a consequence of that. When the Jews saw him later, they captured him. And they charged him with polluting the temple because they said he had taken Trophimus, who was an Ephesian, into the temple. And he was a Gentile. Now, the charge is really far-fetched, because Luke tells us very simply that they'd assumed because they saw him in the city that he'd take him into this temple. Now that's quite a jump in assumption. But that starts the uproar, and they capture Paul, and in the process of beating him, certainly with the intent of killing him, when Claudius Lysias, the captain of the guard, captures him away from the Jews. That was his obligation, his responsibility. Now that begins a series of events. And the first event that we find in chapter 22 is Paul's defense before this mob of Jews. And they listen to him as long as he's speaking about some things they agree with, until finally he talks about the fact that God said, "I'm going to send you far away to the Gentiles." This is verse 21. And they became enraged, and they began to throw dirt up into the air and to tear their garments. And Paul was barely freed from their attempts again to kill him. Now, there were certain Jews that laid a plot against him. And they said, we're not going to eat or drink till we've killed Paul. And this was made aware by Paul's nephew, to Claudius Lysias. And the events began to unfold. And Claudius Lysias prepares an armed guard to take Paul away from the city of Jerusalem to protect him and take him to Caesarea. And so Paul now journeys to Caesarea. In Caesarea, he makes a defense of himself before Festus when the Jews with Tertullus come up and make a charge against him. And the charges are just so absurd. And you find this lawyer making the case for the Jews. And it's just so ridiculous. But before Festus, Paul gets the chance to preach the gospel. And then, as the events continue to unfold, we find him making a defense before Felix. And in his defense before Felix, again, the opportunity to preach to one who is a ruler, a governor. And when word comes through Festus, Paul, are you willing to go back down to Jerusalem and make your defense there? He knows that if he goes to Jerusalem, he's not going to live. And he says, I appeal my case to Caesar. He had the right to because he was a Roman citizen. And then finally, when Agrippa shows up, and Felix is wanting to show favor for Agrippa, then he brings Paul in again, and Paul makes his defense before Agrippa. King Agrippa, do you know the things? You understand these things? And Agrippa says, almost thou persuadest me to be a Christian. Paul did a pretty good job. But before these three men, he had the opportunity to preach. What did God say through Ananias when Ananias first came to Saul of Tarsus and said, you are a chosen vessel. You're going to appear before kings. Now, I'm certain that when Paul first heard this, he could not have anticipated how it was going to happen. But when he appealed to Caesar and finally started on that trip, from the seacoast going down below the island of Crete, and finally because they thought the winds were favorable, and then they set out for the journey to Rome, and the winds then became contrary, and they ended up shipwrecked on the island of Malta. And Paul all along had said, don't go because there's danger. And yet he says, God has told me that you're going to be preserved and no lives are going to be lost. And finally, Paul ends up in Rome. He makes a defense before Caesar himself. How could a man who was just a preacher of the gospel have had an audience with kings and finally the emperor himself of the Roman Empire? It could have been accomplished maybe in lots of ways, but only in the way that God provided in His providence and His foresight. And when Paul prayed to the Roman brethren, he says, I want to come to see you. I want to impart some gift to you. And pray for the Lord also that I may be able to do this. And they prayed for him. Do you think they understood how God was going to do that? Certainly not. But now after the fact, when we look at it, we can see it. When they look at it, they could see it. God worked it out. And sometimes through the maneuvering of the evil men and the attempts on the part of men to do what was evil and bad and kill Paul, and yet God accomplished this because God is sovereign over the world. He's the Creator. He's in control. I take great comfort when I read passages like this and I see how God has worked in the lives of people. And God does not talk directly to me and say, all right, now here's what's going to happen in your life and you're going to learn how it's going to happen. I don't know what that will is. I know that I have to put my trust in God as my Creator. And I know that when I pray, Thy will be done. And I resign myself to things of which I have no control. Things that at some point in time I may question. And my faith may be weak. And I might say, God, if You really love me and You care for me, how could these things happen? But look at the great faithful men of old. Joseph, Paul. How could things like that have happened? Because God was planning and purposing through them to accomplish a greater good. And they didn't just look at little isolated events and question the sovereignty of God. They saw the end result. And you, my friend, as a Christian, should take great comfort in the fact that God rules in the affairs of men. He's the Creator. We are the created. So when we pray, pray and ask in faith. But always pray, Thy will be done. We know what His will is for us in reference to how He expects us to live and how He expects us to act. What He wants us to do in obeying it. We know that because He's revealed that. That other part of the will, we don't know. It unfolds as time passes in our lives. If you'd be a Christian tonight, we can't appeal to you on the basis of what I think and what I like and some judgment about your life and say, well, you look like you're prospering and you're a nice person. That means you're all right with God. Doesn't mean any such thing. Because God's will is revealed. And you must learn His will and abide by it. Would you obey Him tonight? He has the right, because He's the Creator, to command and expect you to obey. And only when your life comes in harmony with the will of God can you really be a happy person living with a purpose that is beyond this life. Put your faith in Jesus. Tonight come and be baptized and all your sins be washed away. You know you're right, not by how you feel, but because of what God has revealed. And then you live a life that regardless of what happens in your life, day by day, you don't know what all is going to happen. Time and chance and circumstance and laws of nature, all of these things play a part in your life. But you have the assurance of the great God of the world who loves you. And He says, I love you, I will care for you, I'll answer your prayers, I will protect you, I will guard you. Men may do things to you, but they can't harm your soul. Put your trust in Me. If you need to respond, won't you, as we stand and sing the selected song.